Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman with you, broadcasting live, noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time, and variations thereof all across the planet, 5 days a week. Right here, live radio stations across the country, Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, CRN Digital. Soaring numbers of American children are being prescribed antipsychotic drugs. Are drug companies taking control of our children? Is this the Brave New World? Aldous Huxley's novel, Brave New World, published back, as I recall, back in the 1950s, I think. He talked about Soma. The drug that everybody took, you know, frankly, my take on it is that the modern equivalent of Soma is television. But you look at some of these numbers and they're spooky because antipsychotic drugs are basically drugs that are designed to reduce you to drooling zombie status. You know, in high dosage, in low dosage, they just move you in the direction of drooling zombie status. We're not talking, this is not even, you know, the Ritalin and Speed and stuff, although those are up as well. It's another story, but antipsychotics being given to kids, this really concerns me. Especially, it's being given to kids for ADD. According to Lindsay Tanner, writing a medical writer for the Associated Press, the annual number of children prescribed antipsychotic drugs jumped fivefold between 1995 and 2002. From 8.6 out of every 1,000 children, 8 out of every 1,000 kids on antipsychotics in the mid-90s, now it's 40 out of every 1,000 children, or 4 out of every 100. Or 2 out of every 50, or 1 out of every 25 children in America on antipsychotic medications? And then they go on to say more than half of the prescriptions were for non-psychotic conditions like attention deficit disorder. This, to me, smacks of classroom management by pharmaceuticals. I remember when my wife's grandmother, at the age of 92, as I recall, When Grandma went into a nursing home, this was back maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we were living in Vermont, and we saw a sudden change in her behavior. She went from being rather crotchety but pretty sharp. She just physically couldn't get around anymore. And, you know, to the point where she needed more help than my mother-in-law, her mother could provide, or her daughter could provide for her. She went from that to being somebody else. And my mother-in-law and my wife got involved in this, and they discovered that this nursing home had just been drugging her. And there was this huge battle to get her off these drugs. And what they were doing was basically giving old people drugs to get them to shut up and sit in the corner and be quiet. Is the same thing happening in our schools? The increasing use, Lindsay Tanner writes in the Associated Press, the increasing use of antipsychotics since the mid-1990s corresponds with the introduction of costly and heavily marketed medications such as Zyprexa and Risperidol. Now, Risperidol has been around forever. They say this is costly. This stuff should have, I mean, I'm not a detail man for a pharmaceutical company. Maybe they've changed the formula recently or something, but that's a drug that's been around for a long time. It should be in generic. In any case, the packaging information for both says their safety and effectiveness in children has not been established. The drugs have typically cost several dollars per pill, can have serious side effects, including weight gain, elevated cholesterol, and diabetes. At the same time, there's this new thing called Teen Screen popping up all around the country. Article by Mary Collins. Teen Screen is a mental health screening system. Using a computer program, teenagers are asked questions to root out the symptoms of, quote, mental illness, end quote. Those students giving the right or wrong answers to the questions are then delivered to persons trained to spot psychiatric disorders, usually employees of local mental health treatment facilities. Teen Screen claims to be funded mainly by private foundations, the identities of which are carefully kept secret, writes Mary Collins.
Teen Screen's critics claim that the operation is nothing but a slick marketing tool designed to bring new customers into the multi-billion dollar psychiatric mental health industry. Teen Screen, by the way, does not have a diagnostic category for normal teenage angst. The positive results always lead towards specific psychiatric mental disorders like depression disorder or anxiety disorder. Questions like, has there ever been a time when you felt you couldn't do anything well or that you weren't as good looking or as smart as other people? If you answered that question yes, you'd be flagged as having potentially depression and shipped off to a psychologist, psychiatrist, or social worker for diagnosis. This is spooky. And no, I'm not a member of the Church of Scientology. It's just, this is just absolutely spooky. In addition, use of attention deficit drugs rose nearly 19% among kids ages 20 to 44. Now, oddly, ironically, strangely, whatever, use of these stimulant drugs for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is actually decreasing in very young children, which I think is a good thing. The brains are very, very plastic at these early ages. In my humble opinion, only in the most extreme of cases should we intervene in anybody's brain with a chemical, particularly a child. But now we're seeing young adults, 20 to 44, up 20%, or 19%. An estimated 1.7 million U.S. adults and 3.3 million children 19 and younger taking stimulant medication for ADHD. But the biggest jump in use, 19% rise from 2004, was among adults aged 20 to 44. And it's interesting, where I'm broadcasting from, complex of radio station, well, just the town where I'm broadcasting from, there's one of the morning shows, a couple of the hosts on the morning shows talk on the air about how they're taking Ritalin or whatever they're taking. It's spooky. I mean, it's out there all over the place. And just you wonder, what's the deal? Well, you don't wonder. It's an industry. There's money to be made. And it's an incredibly wealthy industry. It's an industry that has the ear of George W. Bush. Here's another piece in USA Today. This is interesting. This isn't a rant about this, but about the pharmaceutical companies coming after us or seeing us as customers rather than as people who actually have problems. Each year, 10 to 14 million Americans experience clinical depression, and what they found is that women who are treated for clinical depression, mothers who are treated for clinical depression, and this doesn't specify, this article by Rita Rubin in today's USA Today, doesn't specify whether we're talking about psychiatric treatment, which would be drugs, or whether we're talking about psychological treatment, which would be talk therapy, behavior management, changing environment, things like that. But they did point out that when mothers are treated and they experience less depression, their children experience less depression. Among children of mothers who are still depressed, there was an 8% rise in diagnoses, and which raises an interesting question. There was a piece that I saw. This was I'm going to have to put this out as purely anecdotal data. I wrote about it in one of my books, And even at that time, I had the transcript from the program, and I'm not sure where it is now, but this was 10, 15 years ago or so, back when the gorillas in the mist thing and all that, people were looking at primates, and the observation had been made that primates, that the higher apes, experienced depression at about the same rate as humans, 5, 10%, whatever the number is. And that it also appears to be like humans. They kind of take turns being depressed. It's episodic. And that the symptoms are very similar. They become socially disengaged. They withdraw to the perimeter of the group. They don't participate socially. And so there was a study done in Eastern Africa. My recollection is it was in Kenya, where they went in and they found a troop of chimpanzees. They identified the depressed monkeys, the depressed chimpanzees, hit them with a dart, tranquilized them, pulled them out, took them out of the area, and they said, oh, let's see what happens. And they were expecting the rest of the monkeys to turn into party animals, right? The bummer monkeys are gone. A year later, the troop is dead. Why are they dead? Because the depressed ones were the early warning system. Because they had socially disengaged, because they weren't participating with the others, and they didn't sleep well, they were hypervigilant, they were the ones who always noticed the python coming through the jungle or the lion trying to sneak up on the group, and they were the ones who sounded the alarms. And the psychologist who conducted the study said, perhaps in humans it's the same thing. You look at the depressives among us, people like Franz Kafka and Ernest Hemingway, who with their writings were waving flags saying, look out! Kafka in particular, Albert Camus, you know, who committed suicide. Hemingway committed suicide. But still, they were waving the flag, look out, there's problems. You know, look out for fascism in the case of Kafka in particular. And are we medicating our own internal early warning system out of our culture? In our drive to have everybody be the same, everybody made out of ticky-tacky, and we all look just the same, we all behave just the same, and all our schools are just alike. I don't think it's healthy, I got to say. Although at the same time, you know, I agree with Brooke Shields, people in trouble need help. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Psycho cowboy, yippee-yi, whoopee-whoopee-tie, whoopee-whoopee-tie. Don't run away.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Our telephone number 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM. And our live chat room you can find at tomhartman.com. Just drop by, drop in, say hi, and hang out with some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. It's just absolutely great. George in Westford, Massachusetts on the line. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how are you doing this afternoon?
Great, but I'll get better, George.
One thing I think might be going on with a lot of these drugs is the way the pharmaceutical companies push doctors to prescribe drugs. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean, if you've ever been to a doctor's office when a pharmaceutical luncheon shows up, they will spend hundreds of dollars at a time to get 10 minutes of FaceTime with the doctor, or 15 minutes, or 20 minutes, or however long they can get, to tell them the wonders of their drugs as the doctors and staff eat the food that this particular pharmaceutical rep provided to them.
Yeah.
And which brings up, you know, first off, is this a conflict of interest? Are they trying to unfairly influence a physician into giving a drug that may or may not really be necessary?
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to work in the field, and I see it a lot.
Yeah.
And to me, I think that between that and the nonstop advertising of these drugs, you know, to make yourself more wonderful, take the purple pill or whatever the advertisement du jour happens to be.
Yeah. Well, it's part of our culture, and it has been for a long time. You know, the whole idea of better living through chemistry,
mm-hmm.
you know, right out of the 60s, the old slogan from Dow Chemical, as I recall. And, you know, there is this idea that we can sculpt the perfect person by using psychoactive drugs. And I just want to be very clear. On the one hand, there are some people who are in serious crisis, and there are some pharmaceuticals that are truly useful for them. And unlike the Scientologists, I wouldn't throw that baby out with the bathwater. On the other hand, I think that the really aggressive marketing of this stuff, and particularly some of these new testing schemes and programs, and George W. Bush's, you know, idea that they floated earlier in the year or earlier last year, to psychologically profile or test every school child in the United States looking for disorders, I think, frankly, is, you know, it's a hustle on the part of the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, and it's also seemingly very Republican to make us all very vanilla.
Yeah, there you go.
It's
George,
all exactly
thanks.
The same.
Yep, thanks a lot for the call.
Have a good
to hear
one.
From you. You too. Scott in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Tom, good to talk to you again. I wanted to echo your comment of there are people that are serious in need, and I'm all for warning against wholesale prescribing of these drugs.
Right.
But I've been on Adderall for ADHD, which I know you're very up on the subject.
Yeah, I've written seven books on it.
Yeah, for 6 years now.
Uh-huh.
and I come from a family with a long, long line of mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had had Adderall in my adolescent and teen years, I can imagine my life being a whole lot better, a whole lot more productive, and a whole lot happier than it was.
Yeah, and it may well be true. I'm not going to argue with you about that, Scott. I know that for a lot of people, these drugs, as I said, can be very, very useful. On the other hand, I'm assuming that you're familiar with the Adderall, or not, I don't want to specifically pick on one particular, that the stimulant family of drugs seem to be associated with increased risk of heart problems in adults, particularly with regard to long-term use.
That's true, and I'm actually a person with high blood pressure.
Yeah, so, I mean, you might be trading a heart attack for being organized.
Well, the other side of it is, the same way stimulants don't stimulate the ADHD person, my resting pulse went down, and my blood pressure went down soon after starting Adderall, because my mind was less active.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because by and large, the old theory of the paradoxical effect has been discredited. But it's interesting that you had that experience. Well, Scott, you know, I'm glad it's working for you.
Thank you, Tom. You know, good talking to you guys.
Yeah, good talking to you, too. Dan in Aberdeen, Washington. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I worked for a lot of years in the business, so I can say what you're saying on the air is really, really, really true. One clinic I worked at, I worked inpatient and outpatient. Every child seen there was put on Ritalin.
Mm-hmm.
And about a third of them were hospitalized in
Wow. Private
psych institutions, you know, for money to milk insurance.
Yeah, and see, what I think we're seeing really is a symptom of the breakdown of our society. We're seeing the breakdown of our public institutions as a consequence of 25 years, going on 26 years now, of assault by conservatives to destroy our public schools.
Yeah.
We're looking at the breakdown of the family as a consequence of 25 years of conservative warfare on the middle class. So now two people have to work to raise a family, so more than half of all American children come home to an empty home. We're seeing the breakdown of family functions. Families used to get together for meals. Now kids are eating alone in their room in front of their TV set. And these all together, they seem, you know, individually like individual social ills or individual problems, but they accumulate, particularly on kids, to produce, in my opinion, real crises in terms of their ability to learn, their ability to be socialized. And then we say, oh, well, we've got the solution here. Just take this pill. And it's... it just doesn't seem like a good plan to me. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And I don't want to make the whole show about that, but I just, you know, it's the kind of thing that I think needs to be said periodically. It's just just be on the record, be out there. Exposing the con and conservative, 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Listening to you, I get the music. Gazing at you, I get the heat. Following you, I climb the mountain. I get excitement at your feet.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. On the True People's Radio, this is from the USA Today, actually, today. A walk in the park could be an effective treatment for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, some researchers believe. Now, this is an actual study. It was published in the American Journal of Public Health. And they found that when people went outside and got 20 minutes of outdoor activity, that their ability to focus returned. Interesting. So instead of telling your kids you have to do your homework before you can go outside, what you should be doing is saying, go outside for 20 minutes or a half hour, and then after you're done playing, come on in and do your homework. And you get better results. Very interesting. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenny, what's on your mind today?
How you doing? I got two questions for you.
Sure.
Just want to know... Did Iran switch over the oil to the based off the euro?
I don't know. I've been looking for a story on to that effect, and I can't find one, so I'm assuming that they have not.
And my next question is, if this economy falls apart, I have EE bonds. and I want to know, would my EE bonds be safe or would it be worthless?
The odds are that your bonds will be safe. The last thing probably that would go are government debt instruments. They really and truly probably are the safest kind of, you know, debt instrument, the investment that you can make. On the other hand, those EE bonds are denominated in U.S. dollars. And if the economy really goes south really hard, really fast, in all probability, it's not going to go south the way it did in 1929 with a deflation, where the dollar becomes worth more. Instead, it'll probably go south with a hyperinflation, more like happened in Germany in the 1930s, late 1920s, because we've been following the same path that they've been following, which means that, you know, you say you've got a, you know, $10,000 in treasury bill or EE bond, that $10,000 might buy you, you know, 5 loaves of bread, you know, instead of what it'll buy you right now. This is interesting. This was a small, you know, kind of one of those small obscure articles in the Wall Street Journal that I shared with my listeners here last week, I think it was, at the beginning of last week, maybe the end of the week before. So it's been a week and a half, more or less, thereabouts, that the investments by, you know, substantial institutional investors in the United States in foreign funds and stock funds that are, you know, on foreign stock exchanges has gone up by, you know, some incredible percentage, 2.5 times, you know, this year over last year, whereas the investment in U.S.-based stock funds has declined. So, you know, a lot of people saying that they want to get out of the dollar right now, which is a scary trend.
Well, is gold be safer then?
Well, you know, I'm really reluctant to give investment advice, or anything like that. Gold certainly historically has been a form of safe investment, something that people flee to. There's a lot of talk right now that gold, which is more or less around $550, could go to $800 or $1,000. If the dollar goes south, if the dollar falls apart, then yeah, for sure. But over the short term, you know, it could go down another $100. It could go up $200, $300. It's just really, really hard to say. And Kenny, thanks a lot for the call. John Conyers is with us, Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. Congressman Conyers, welcome to the program.
Tom Hartman, you're still doing good things for the people by bringing information to them, and I'm grateful to you for it.
Well, thank you so much, sir. You are still doing great things for the people of the United States by stepping out and taking principled stands rather than just doing what's politically safe. You are really and truly one of my heroes, and I'm so pleased to have you on the program. I'm curious what the status is of House Resolution 635, your bill that would call for an investigation.
Select committee.
Yeah.
To be set up to take into cognizance all of the things that we pulled together in our 6-month staff report about what the president had been doing about the war in Iraq, what kind of misinformation and exaggerations were employed, what the thrust of the Downing Street memos were, in which it was revealed that an Iraq war was being planned long before there was any congressional authority giving the president additional military force. We also were concerned about the Geneva Convention preventions of torture, which seemed to be not only violated then, but are still violated now.
You have some.
And of course, the retaliation tactics of the administration with reference to the CIA agent Valerie Plame.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to do is find out whether all this information is as bad as it sounds, and the best way to do it, to subpoena people and get documents, is to have a select committee, which is evenly composed of Republicans and Democrats, and both the chairman and the vice chairman have subpoena authority.
Now, you have 31, 32 co-sponsors. Have you been picked up more?
33 now.
33
it's
now.
Going up.
Yeah, great. What's it going to take?
Every week.
My sense of it is that this is going to take the Democrats taking back the House of Representatives in November for this to succeed. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. There's no likelihood that the Republicans will join me in this activity. But what we're sending a message to is Americans, Democratic and Republican, that there is something being done and that we are examining whether the president is abusing his powers and whether he's fulfilling his oath of office.
I'm curious, Congressman John Conyers, Cindy Sheehan testified before you that that George W. Bush had told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, in 1999, before he was even running for president, that if he had an opportunity to invade Iraq, he would do so in order to gain political capital so that he could get his programs pushed through and be known by history as a successful president. That is the most craven of reasons to go to war, for political capital. Have you found more evidence to back up Cindy Sheehan's assertion that that's the main reason why we went into Iraq?
Well, that's exactly why we need a select committee. I mean, we need people under oath, not hearsay, to determine the accuracy of this. And that's what Senator Sam Ervin did in Watergate in 1974. It's a preliminary investigation, and it could actually exculpate as well as incriminate. I mean, it works both ways, because what we have collected is public information, articles, magazines, television clips, newspapers, hearsay, and that's what we want to find out. And the only way we can do it is to require people to come in and also to take an oath.
Mm-hmm. And over at johnconyers.com, is that your website?
Exactly.
And people can learn more about that. How can people most directly support you? I've called the offices of all of the members of Congress that are in my area, and certainly my representative, Darlene Hooley, and said, please sign on with John Conyers, House Resolution 635. Is there more that could be done? That I should be doing?
Well, yes. I mean, a telephone call is a good way to start it off, but direct meetings with one's representatives is the best way.
Hmm.
Because everybody's going to have to account for what they did or chose not to do when they start writing the history of this era.
Hmm.
And I think more and more people are signing on because this is percolating from the bottom up, Tom. It's a situation in which people's representatives are being touched by their constituents who require that they do this. And once people start thinking through it, that's how it builds up, but it's got to be a grassroots movement.
From the bottom up.
It's something like the anti-Vietnam protest.
Right. We have less than a minute left, Congressman Conyers. I'm wondering if your efforts to investigate what went wrong in Ohio have gotten any further.
Well, they got quite a bit further because we were able to introduce legislation that spoke to many of the problems that we found out that were occurring on election day and sometimes weeks and months before election day, because the Secretary of State did a very effective job that indicates that he was trying to discourage people from voting rather than making it easier for them to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so we put together legislation, but in lockstep, the Republicans will not allow us to have a hearing on it. And one of the big problems, of course, was the fact that much of the technology doesn't leave a paper trail. Diebold and
it's a terrible problem. Congressman John Conyers, you are absolutely one of my heroes and a great American. JohnConyers.com. Everybody, please check it out. Congressman Conyers, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm always honored to talk with you, even if it's for a short period of time.
Thank you, sir.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's just
welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour, more or less.
About 9.5 minutes for those of you who are fastidious about such things. The program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Our program brought to you in part today by EcoWine, 1-888-ECO-WINE, E-C-O-W-I-N-E, for incredible tasting French organic wines. Imported from the family vineyard. You want to talk to Veronique, give her a call. 1-888-ECO-WINE. E-C-O-W-I-N-E. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. And Larry, you know something in Iraq? Yeah, Iran and the euro that I don't know?
Yeah, Tom. The only thing I could find on it was the 12th and the 13th of March, a week before the 20th, the Iranian New Year, when they were scheduled to start there, the bourse trading in euros.
Right.
They had a thing, they had a conference, the International Conference on Energy and Security, Asia Vision.
Mm-hmm.
Saudi Arabia was there, China, Pakistan, Russia, and Germany, oddly enough. There was one little sentence, and all they said was that Iran had been persuaded to not use the nuclear option. I assumed that that's what that was.
Mm. Interesting.
But,
yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but that's not what I wanted to talk to you about. Was the praise that's being thrown on David Kelly and Spader for that dialogue that they had in the show on ABC? Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can. I'm listening. Because I didn't see it, and so I'm not sure. You're talking about the Boston Legal thing.
What is that?
You're talking about the Boston Legal Risk.
Yes, I am. I don't have a TV either, but I saw it on BuzzFlash or someplace this morning.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean,
they're getting a lot of flack from the right. There's an organized campaign from the right wing now to call ABC and try and get that show kicked off. It's just a huge hysteria, hissy fit on the right.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I don't know. It might actually even play into their hands. I mean, it's a bad idea. It's just the Grover Norquist argument of shrinking government and say you can drown it in the bathtub. You know, we don't like what you're doing, so with our tax dollars, and we're not going to pay them to you. Mm-hmm. But it's just coming from our side.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah. You know, if we have a million people lined up not paying their taxes April 15th, progressives, because they don't like the war, then you're going to have three times that many the same day saying, we're not giving you money until you reassess the Civil Rights Act of 64 or something.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's a tough one, Larry. I remember, you know, and thank you for calling and pointing that out. One of my very first jobs early on in radio, I was working. I'd been a DJ for a couple of years, and I was working. I did news for 7 years at a radio station in Lansing, Michigan. And we were in the newsroom one day, and a couple of guys in suits with conspicuously shiny black shoes showed up and identified themselves as being from the IRS and the FBI. And they took down. They asked us for our driver's licenses and our social security numbers. And we were sufficiently intimidated by them. I mean, I was like 20 years old, you know. We were sufficiently intimidated by them that we gave them that information. And then they said that there was going to be a bust of some tax resisters in central Michigan that afternoon. They were going to arrest a dozen people, something like that. And they would appreciate it if we didn't cover it because they didn't want to encourage tax resistance. And they left, and we had a fierce debate in the newsroom about this. And the news director, who even all these years later, I suspect he's not proud of that moment. I'm not going to identify him. The news director was the guy who had made the final call, and he decided to not cover it. And as far as I know, no media in Michigan covered that story, or at least in central Michigan where I was, in the Lansing area. And, that's a hot topic. And, you know, I don't think that they're quite as Gestapo-like as they were, but... you know, coming after you. By the way, with regard to the Iranian oil bourse, this morning I was speaking with Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon, and I asked him what his take on what might happen if the U.S. moved away from the dollar. He said that, and he told me this on the air on my morning program on KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, so I'm not talking out of school here. He said that he had been talking with a couple of guys from the State Department, And one of the, and he asked them what would happen if the world went off the dollar as the standard for oil. And they said words to the effect of, it would be a disaster for the United States, an absolute disaster. So, interesting, interesting. Derek in Orange County, California. Hey, Derek, what's on your mind today?
Derek, good morning to you, or good afternoon to you there, Tom. Tim Dyer, talking Roosevelt legacy. Been mm-hmm. thinking about this a long time. 90% tax on earned income over $1 million?
Well, actually, in today's dollars, it would be over about $6 million, but yeah.
Great. Perfect. I'm talking 1964, the greatest distribution of wealth ever seen in the history of the human race, largest blue-collar middle class in the Western industrialized world. That 90% plus 50-plus percent on unearned income, 50-plus percent on massive estates, mega wealth like the Waltons.
Mm-hmm.
These, you've written about this.
Yeah.
They gave us the middle class that That's we right. had at that time.
They created it. It's the middle class is not a natural thing in a,
no.
in a laissez-faire capitalist society. Oh. Usually what you end up
Slave
with is...
society is the natural.
Yeah.
3,000 years.
Yeah.
The many and the few.
Yeah.
Last little piece,
yeah.
the lie of corporate super citizenship that you've written about so well. The 1886 case, the header. Here's the takeaway. This is why I'm calling. You're going to be talking to a lot of happy-faced Democrats on this microphone in the coming election. The only way we are going to restore any kind of middle class is to restore that legacy.
I don't disagree with you at all, Derek. And, you know, well said. We've got to get out there and speak. And on the other hand, you've got the guys on the right who are...
Roosevelt is dead! His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Those guys don't want there to be a middle class. They're pretty upfront about it. You know, union's terrible. Anything that contributes to a strong middle class, nah. Conservatives don't want there to be anything to do with it. Nothing but the conservative elite. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, Tom Hartman with you. And Jeffrey Feldman with us. Jeffrey is the editor-in-chief of frameshopisopen.com. Be sure you get the is open in there. frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey Feldman, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
Jeffrey, chain of concern. This is fascinating. Right up at the top of frameshopisopen.com, you're talking about how George Bush is basically on the there's kind of two things here to talk about. The first is that Bush is telling us, don't believe your own lying eyes, right? In other words, what you see on the news about the war in Iraq, that's not the real war. You got to deal with the war on the ground. And then you say, well, it's easy to dismiss that as an attack on the media, but there's a deeper issue here. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I mean, listening to the president's press conference yesterday, he picked up on an idea that, in fact, Rumsfeld had been pushing for quite some time, but when the president says it, it has more force. And that's the idea that the reason Americans are concerned about the war is because of what they're seeing in the media. It's an old drum that he's beating, that we're seeing only the negative images and not the positive images. And the argument that I put forward in the Post today is that what the president is doing, as you said, there's really two things. On the first hand, he's using an old litigator's trick, which is you've got a client who's very guilty, and your task is to convince a jury that that client isn't really guilty, even though he's been caught red-handed. And so what the trick works by breaking down one event into a series of much, much smaller events. In other words, getting people to focus on the trees rather than the forest. And in this case, the forest obviously is a war in Iraq, which is in the midst of transforming from one type of war out of control into another type of war out of control. And the president says, look, over here there may be burning cars, there may be pictures of families that were killed, but we've got schools that look good over here. We've got elections over here, so are things really all that bad? We've got success. Right. And the knee-jerk inclination is to say, go in and defend the media. But what we really need to look at is how the president is trying to frame the debate in terms of representation. What constitutes a real fact versus a false fact? This idea that what we see on TV isn't really real. It's not real unless it's something that's transpiring on the ground. But in fact, the president is incredibly removed from the ground. He gets all his reports from teleconferencing and only from generals, which are very high up in the chain of command. And the argument that I put out is that if you switch the frame to the notion of listening to real people on the ground, to the soldiers, and to asking what is it that the soldiers are saying, then things look very different.
It's kind of using his own frame against him.
Exactly. And what caught my eye was an event that happened just recently in Maine, a protest that was called a Chain of Concern, in which a bunch of military families gathered together in the center of a town and held hands in order to express what they called their concern over what's going on in the war. And this, combined with dropping poll numbers amongst soldiers in Iraq, really is a very convincing argument that the problem with the president is that he's not listening to the people who are most directly involved with what's going on there, not listening to soldiers and their families.
It's interesting. Along those same lines, Jane Smiley, you know, blogging about this, she says, number one, Bush doesn't know that you disagree with him. Nothing about you makes you of interest to George W. Bush once you no longer agree with and support him. No degree of relationship, his own father and mother, for example. No long-standing family relationship, Jack Abramoff. No degree of expertise, Brent Scowcroft. No essential importance, Tony Blair, the American voters, makes any difference. And then she goes on to say, Bush doesn't care whether you disagree with him. You know, he's thrown away the reality-based world.
He doesn't care. He's increasingly surrounded by a smaller and smaller group of people who agree with him. And that really, I believe, is something that's a powerful concept. His inability to hear or to feel the concerns of the public is something that the American people are seeing now, I think, with real clarity. Just recently, the Republicans, in response to Russ Feingold's censure measure against the president, for example, they launched a series of ads which are essentially accusing the Democrats of not wanting or not caring about the security of the American public by virtue of the fact that they want to censure the president.
Right.
And, you know, a year ago, I think that the American public would have responded to that and said, you know what, this isn't a good time to be doing that. But now the American public seems to be a much more immune to those types of attacks because mm-hmm. they see the president for what he is.
You know, we're talking with Jeffrey Feldman. Frameshop is open.com, the website. Jeffrey, one of the great experts in the United States on framing and that dimension of this whole, you know, the NLP of communication here. One of the classic uses of fairy tales and whatever those short stories are, Humpty Dumpty, you know, the little poems and things.
Those were
back in the days when it was illegal to speak out politically, the way that people spoke out politically. You know, Humpty Dumpty was about a particular king in a particular battle. I forget which one. Little, you know, Mary, quite contrary, was about Mary, Queen of Scots. And on it goes. And these were forms of political protest. And the metaphor or the frame of the king who is completely disconnected from reality was, you know, is the story of the little boy who pointed out the king had no clothes on, you know, the emperor who had no clothes. At what point do you think that the frame of George Bush as being a boy king, you know, the Louis XVI all over again, who is completely disconnected from reality, at what point do you think that frame might pick up some traction? Because it certainly seems, frankly, like that's actually the reality.
It is the reality, and I think that it's picking up traction within this idea of management that's being put out by one half of the Democratic Party. I mean, there are two competing ideas right now, two competing frames that Democrats are talking about in order to define what constitutes good leadership. On the one hand, you have people like Russ Feingold who are saying that leadership consists of strong, bold action, speaking back to power, and so forth. On the other hand, you've got people such as Mark Warner who are saying that leadership consists of competent management. And when you are not a competent manager, you are incompetent. And there was a Pew poll that came out last week in which the number one word in terms of percentage points that Americans are using to describe the president right now is incompetent.
Right.
Sadly, the word honest, not incredibly far behind, but nonetheless, incompetent is right up there. And when the public in general is talking about the president as being incompetent, then I think you've got that convergence of the reality of how policy is being structured in the White House with the frame that the Democrats are trying to control.
Well, it's interesting. In most other democracies, you have these functions split in half, particularly in the democracies that still have royal families. You have the head of state, who is the ceremonial person or is perceived as the leader. And then you have the head of government, who is perceived as the efficient bureaucrat. So you have the Queen, and then you have the Prime Minister, for example, in the United Kingdom. And so the strong, bold leadership that Russ Feingold is doing, speaking truth to power, that's kind of the Queen part. Maybe the UK is a bad analogy, but you know, in countries, you know, like Italy, for example, where you've got a president and a prime minister, that's that figurehead part. And then the competent manager, that's that head of government part. And yet, in the United States, we expect the president to be both.
We do, and keep in mind that the model that the president has brought to the Oval Office is that of a CEO. Neither a good bureaucrat nor a good, a symbolic head or good manager, someone who has controlling interest, has the most stock options, really, and who stands to benefit the most, but then who delegates everything and is only trotted out on occasion to speak to the largest shareholders.
Right, and he himself was never a competent CEO. He screwed up every business he owned.
Exactly.
Now, another frame, we have about a minute and a half left here, Jeffrey. Another frame that you laid out in frameshopisopen.com, talking with Jeffrey Feldman, is the bank manager and the basketball coach. This is a variation on this conversation we're having right now.
Exactly. I think that what's fascinating about what's going on inside the Democratic Party right now is that there's a real struggle over what will define the character of our leading candidates going into the next elections. And on the one hand, you've got what I call the don't rock the boat crowd. People that are being criticized by the progressive, by the grassroots of the party as being too concerned about raising their voices. There's a great article by Molly Ivins last week in which she described candidates like Mark Warner as being anodyne, as being defined by their reluctance to actually rock the boat. On the other hand, the group that I call the crash the gate people, folks, you know, spearheaded by Feingold, who are raising their voices and saying, you know, we have to rise up and take action. And I associate these with bank managers on the one hand and coaches on the other. And the point that I was trying to make is that it seems that the notion of a basketball coach, someone who stands up and really grabs the attention of the team, is something that is gaining a lot of steam right now. But that can only go so far unless we're managed to pull together a good management team underneath that in order to build a group of people that can actually implement those ideas. So I made the recommendation that the public is really reaching for a coach-type figure rather than a CEO or a manager, but that if that figure, someone like Feingold, really wants to gain traction, then he should put together a really strong team of management underneath in order for people to have confidence that he can actually follow through with that passion.
Yeah, I think that Americans have a lot of respect for presidents. Well, Bill Clinton, for example, who played the role of cheerleader fairly well, or of leader, let's say, and yet at the same time was a micromanager. Was very involved in what was going on a day-to-day basis.
Exactly.
And so the challenge for the Democratic Party is to find somebody who can wear both those hats, in my opinion. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, the website. Check it out. Jeffrey, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Great speaking with you. Fascinating stuff. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, let's change this country back to the ideals that we once held and the values that we once stood for. Democracy, truth, justice, peace, freedom in the American way. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. with us deep in the belly of the beast there, Greg. What's going on today?
Well, a few things. I'm watching the president's speech right now in Wheeling, West Virginia. He's talking to a bunch of military families. Well, and civilians, I guess I should say. And he was just asked a very interesting question, Tom, by someone in the audience who said, look, you know, I understand what you're going for in the war on terror, but, you know, as you know, Mr. President, a man was just killed for trying to convert from Islam, you know, over to Christianity. How are you going to change the minds of people in that region of the world who think it's okay to kill someone? And are you going to send a sociology team over there to talk to people, you know, to let them understand
And I said, no, no, we're just going to bomb them until they think just like we do. We just bomb them enough.
You know, Tom, it's almost what he said, and he never answered the question. He appreciated the question three times. He tried to answer. He never answered. And then I'm not lying. He turned around and took a question from a six-year-old child about what's it like to live in the White House, if he likes to live in the White House.
Amazing.
I mean, he's so not focused on anything that matters, it seems like. When he makes these kinds of speeches, he stands up in front of people. He tries to diffuse everything. He doesn't have real answers. And when he's finally asked a real question, how are you going to change the real hearts and minds of these people? And how are you going to start a democracy in a place that thinks it's okay to kill someone if they want to change their religion? And he has no answer. And I think that's very telling.
Well, all he has is sound bites. And it's a bubble boy. Every time any of his advisors have contradicted what he wants, he fires them.
That's right.
So I don't think that the guy is in touch with the real world, frankly. I wonder if his wife is. I wonder if he's getting, even information from inside his own family. He's basically written off his own father, although, apparently that happened a long time ago.
Right.
Amazing.
Well, and there was this whole issue, Tom, about, should he bring some old, wise Washington, graybeard into the White House?
Like Brent Scowcroft? who he won't talk to?
Yeah. And, he said he appreciates everyone's suggestions. He listens to suggestions, but they don't seem to permeate his bubble. So it looks like we're going to be stuck with another 2.5 years of someone who lives in a bubble, who pays attention to people saying exactly what he wants to hear, and don't tell him the truth.
1,034 days, 10 hours, 37 minutes, and 19 seconds, Greg.
I knew if there was anyone who would know that, Tom, it would have been you.
It was given to me as a gift, actually, by a local car mechanic, Tom Dwyer Automotive here in Portland, Oregon. And it's days left in office. It's a little calculator, and it's ticking away.
I love it.
Yeah, it's cool. It says Bush backwards, and backwardsbush.com apparently is where they come from. Anyhow, so what else is happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, the other thing going on today, there was a very interesting Supreme Court decision that came out today in a case called Georgia v. Randolph. It was a 5-3 decision, and this was the case that are the police allowed, without a search warrant, to come to your home if there are two residents inside the home? If one of the residents says that the police are allowed to come inside and the other resident says that they are not, what do the police do? And in a 5-3 decision, and the five being Souter and Kennedy and Ginsburg and Breyer and Stevens, said that no, as long as one person inside the home says the police cannot come in, it means they cannot come inside.
And Roberts and Thomas
and
Scalia.
Roberts and Scalia and Thomas have voted, as a group, as we will see probably as precedent now. It's not going to change. The only thing that will change is when Justice Alito finally starts ruling on decisions of cases he's heard, he'll probably join that group.
Right.
And so now the police cannot come in your home without a warrant if one person inside the home says they cannot. And Justice Roberts actually said, look, this is going to hamper any kind of domestic abuse case. If the police don't have a search warrant and they think that domestic abuse is going on and the man who is perhaps beating up the woman says you can't come in, it means they can't come in.
He's wrong, though.
Obviously extenuating circumstances.
But, yeah, I was going to say, there's kind of a hole in that, and that is that if the police observe what they believe to be a crime, or they have evidence that a crime is happening that they consider to be sufficiently solid, they can act on it right then and there without a warrant. I mean, cops pull you over, and they see a beer bottle next to you half open in the car. They don't need to go find a judge and get a warrant to search your car. They see it. And,
right.
If they open the house and they hear some woman screaming or some guy screaming, whatever, they have the grounds to go in without a warrant.
And obviously
I can't believe Roberts would say that. It must be because Roberts was just a corporate lawyer. He was just a million-dollar-a-year corporate lawyer, and he doesn't understand criminal law.
Well, that's right. And the thing is, of course he knows that, but he didn't write it into the decision, which makes us think that he didn't want to.
Interesting. Interesting. So what is this, police state? I mean, is that these Roberts, Alito, or Scalia and Thomas, that's just police state is just fine with them?
It seems to be fine with them, and they have, we'll see.
Just get away
with it over the next few years.
Yeah, that nasty old Fourth Amendment. We just don't need that Constitution anymore. Greg Gorman, TalkRadioNews.com. Greg, thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Always great having you here. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where being progressive never felt so good.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
There's some really great musicians. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you with the water cooler wars. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. And Justin in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Justin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Nice to speak with you. I was struck by George Bush's news conference yesterday, where when the issue of removing troops from Iraq was brought up, he stated, quote, "That will be decided by future presidents and future governments of Iraq."
Right.
And it seems to me that that's a layup for the that something could be framed that would benefit the 2006 and the next presidential election to benefit the Democrats.
I disagree. I think that it was just Bush stating what in his mind is the obvious, which is that he has no plans of leaving there.
Well, but this is the first time I think we've heard any kind of timeline for removal. We've been insisting on, you know, some sort of reasonable plan to remove troops, and he has just stated that it won't be the next president. It could be the next fifth president. And that is something
future,
the American public bought into with all of his other arguments, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think the American, you know, we really don't want to have a 30-year occupation of another country, particularly in the Middle East. We don't want it, don't need it. And this is being played up in the press. Fortunately, I think a lot of people are getting it that, you know, Bush has no plans to leave, is not intending to leave. And, frankly, doesn't seem to be all that connected with the crisis that so many of our troops are facing, you know, of their friends dying. And I mean, this is a real, genuine disaster that's going on there.
A layup to help the Democrats? I mean, this should be outraging even the conservatives of the Buchanan wing of the conservative party.
Oh, he's already lost the Buchanan wing. Pat Buchanan wrote a book called Where the Right Went Wrong, which is one of the very best indictments of George W. Bush I've ever read. I actually read Buchanan. It's the only book of Buchanan's that I've ever read either, but you know, at least all the way through. And, he tosses in a gratuitous final chapter where he sucks up to Republicans. But other than that, the whole book is just this absolute, you know, rip them a new one attack on Bush and the Bushies. So, anyway, I got to move along. Justin, thanks for raising the issue. We'll see. You know, time will play this thing out. John in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, John.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Mr. Hartman.
Sure.
I was prompted to call by the gentleman from Frame Shop. I wanted to get your take on a couple of Republican memes that are being put out there in the press, one by the administration, the other by the right-wing blogosphere and talking heads on radio and TV.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, of course, is the attempt to discredit the media. And I think it's an attempt to set up the media as a fall guy, because I think Rumsfeld and Cheney realize that Iraq is essentially lost. I wondered if you believe that Bush is actually coming to the realization that his goals are not going to be realized in Iraq.
No, I don't think so. I really and truly believe that George W. Bush, all his life, I think we're seeing a pattern that goes all the way back to when he was at Andover. I think that he has succeeded because of his extraordinary wealth. The guy was born, you know, a millionaire.
Correct.
And born into a family of multi-millionaires, a dynasty. I think because of his extraordinary wealth, he has been so insulated from any contact with the real world for so long that it's just that he really doesn't know what's going on.
Well, it's true he's never faced any consequences for failure before.
Never.
I do think Cheney...
And I don't think he knows how.
I'm sorry?
You know, one of the things that most of us learn in the course of life, the first business I ever owned back, I was 17 years old. I was a ham radio operator when I was 13. I got my general license. I got an FCC engineering license when I was 16. And the first business I started was a radio TV repair shop, because I was into electronics. I was doing that while I was going to college. I started out as a part-time thing. Within 2 years, we had 4 employees and a payroll, and it was a real business. And I killed that business. It was my first business, and I blew it because I didn't understand. Well, without getting into all the details of it, basically I killed off this business, and I learned from that. And as a consequence of that failure of that business, every business that I've run since then has been successful. And, we built them up and sold them off. And I don't think that George Bush has had an opportunity to learn from any of his failures, because he's always been bailed out. And therefore, he doesn't know how.
Well, I would agree with you there. I do think perhaps Cheney and Rumsfeld realized that the effort is failing. The second thing I wanted to get your take on real quickly is this attempt by right-wing, primarily the blogs and right-wing radio hosts, to attempt to, I guess, reconvince the base that Iraq had an extensive weapons of mass destruction program right up until the war. Yeah. Although, surprisingly, Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard was on CNN today, and when a caller tried to raise that issue with him, he actually said that the tale by General George Sada has essentially been discredited. I was very surprised to hear the man say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain point where once the message has gotten out there, then when a contradictory message gets out, that's okay. It's sort of like, it's like the newspaper does the screaming headline of, John in Greensburg is indicted for bank robbery. And then 2 weeks later, there's this little thing on page 16 that says, it wasn't John, it was Ralph. And the damage has already been done.
Yes.
And so, they'll push the lies really hard. And then when they get a good national splash on them, then they'll back off and go, mistake.
Gotcha. So, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I mean, it's sort of media manipulation 101, but that's what they're doing, and that's how they're doing it. John in Wayland, Michigan. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for giving us truth over your radio station, over your broadcast.
It really
helps us all feel a whole lot better.
You're welcome, and thanks for listening to WTKG, and please support the local advertisers.
No, you betcha I do. Tom, to change gears a little bit, I received an email yesterday announcing that the Michigan legislature had reclassified the Great Lakes from a natural resource to a commodity, and I'm wondering what fallout might ensue from this. As I understand it, the Nestle's Corporation was the main lobbyist on this.
Sure. We're seeing this all across the United States. We're seeing it all over the world, and there's a pushback. There's a strong pushback happening. But and the pushback is to try to say water is access to water is a human right, and water is a necessity of life. And the corporate side of it is trying to say, no, water is a commodity, and a commodity is going to be bought and sold. Whereas if it's a necessity and if access to it is a human right, then it's part of the commons, and it can't be bought and sold. It has to be owned by we the people. And I'm not familiar with the specific legislation that you're talking about, John, but I'm not surprised that this is happening. You see, there are three very, very large water companies. Suez out of France is probably the largest, that are aggressively buying up water supplies across the United States and converting water into commodity. Down in Bolivia, Bechtel was in a partnership. They took over the water supply of a town, I can't remember how it's pronounced, but anyhow, this little town in Bolivia. And they actually said to the people in the town that they had to buy permits and pay for the water that ran off their own roofs. And there was a revolt, and the people took it back. And so Bechtel ended up incorporating a new kind of a separate division in Holland, because Holland had a reciprocal trade agreement with Bolivia so that they could sue Bolivia. And they actually won in the World Court, but they only got like $1 out of it. But they won on the principle of they had the right to privatize the water. And this is the next big thing. I'm telling you, water is going to be a bigger deal than oil over the next 10 years.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I wonder how long it'll be before they start trying to charge us for the rain falling out of the sky if we collect it.
Well, it's probably not very long. Probably not very long. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if some of the communities in the United States that have privatized their water supplies, and there are several hundred of them now, In fact, Jeb Bush down in Florida was in negotiations with Enron to have Enron take over the Everglades when Enron went down in flames, which put an end to that. But that, you know, had that not happened, he was well on his way to make that happen. Where they, it may well be that in a lot of these contracts that are out there, it does say, you know, if water falls out of the sky, it belongs to that corporation. John, thanks for the call and for sensitizing us to that. I'll have to follow up on that. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, well, I was watching President too, and I'll tell you what, you should make a copy of that if you could have time. He really couldn't answer anything. But the one thing he was asked about the energy, and he recommended you don't drive as much. Isn't that something coming from President of the United States?
Which yeah, just quit your job. You know, you don't need to drive to work after all. Don't you have a trust fund like I do?
Well, last night on PCN cable in Pennsylvania, they had the energy people meeting with the Republican caucus, and I didn't know we had meetings in Harrisburg with only one party. But anyway, this one man, he read about a 7-page document to them. They asked him a question. He said, well, I can't answer that. You have to get someone else within the company. And their recommendations, there was about five of them, their recommendations to the state was to give them $50 million for more exploration. What their exploration was so far is paint your roof white to reflect the sunlight.
Yeah.
And insulate your home.
Well, gee.
This is what we're running into. This is what this administration is letting happen all across the country.
Sure.
The hell with the Americans. Let's spend our money, on Halliburton.
And not only that, Jim, the white paint that they want you to buy to paint your roof, they want it made in China.
Oh, yeah.
You depend
hey,
on it.
That's a good work, Tom.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Thanks for listening on WPTD there in Pittsburgh. And support the local advertisers. This is listener-supported radio. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Hey, give them a call and get all the latest iPod accessories, anything Macintosh, and really anything PC. Smalldog.com, also their website. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jackie in Duluth, Minnesota. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
Well, I've just been reading an article in the Airline Pilot magazine of this month, and it's about the failure of the Air Transportation Stabilization Board. And Congress authorized them to provide loan guarantees for the airlines struggling after 9-1-1.
Right.
Congress also charged the board with reinforcing the airline industry as it recovered from an economic disaster.
This was part of that $5 billion bailout, wasn't it, Jackie?
I don't know about that, but Congress authorized them to issue $10 billion in loan guarantees to help the airlines, and especially United and American.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is they've withheld 84% of these funds, and now they're crowing about making a $300 million profit based on their inaction.
Who's the they that you're talking about, Jackie?
The Air Transportation Stabilization Board, and they're run by Bush appointees, of course.
So this board is a for-profit corporation?
I don't know. I think it's an agency of the government.
Does it make a profit then?
Well, it says in the article, was written by the airline pilot president, Captain Worth, and he was talking about their profit is made based on marketing of the loans and the sale of the airline stock and warrants that received from airlines that got the guarantees.
Right.
But the main thing is we see on the news all the time about airline employees are getting their pensions reduced, paying more for health care, and all this time, they could have had guaranteed loans to keep them in the air. I mean, they suffered a enormous...
No, the bottom line, Jackie, is that the Bush administration and the Republicans in the House and the Republicans in the Senate are very, very clear They don't give a damn about the airline employees. You know, the pilots,
don't.
The flight attendants, the baggage handlers, the frontline people who check in, they don't give a damn about them. They are concerned about the profitability. They are concerned about what's going on in the boardroom, period. And, you know, it's pretty much it. And that's...
So when Congress says they're going to do something, why don't they do it?
Well, because what they were doing was they were offering a fig leaf. And, you know, this whole loan guarantees after 9/11, you know, they wanted to keep the airlines flying and all that. But the airlines said, oh, here's an opportunity to do away with the pensions. We'll just declare bankruptcy and, you know, we'll shed some pension obligations. We'll you know, this is really a roundabout way of negotiating with the unions. It's what they've been doing. And it's not right. It's not fair. And it's entirely Republican. Jackie, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's Minnesota Day. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Right. I wanted to mention this to your frame shop guest guy. You know my thing is language and clarity, right?
Oh, yeah.
Liberals keep using the con frame of war on terror, and that is what they keep. We keep saying their frame, and we should say war on Al-Qaeda, distinct and separate from a war on
Iraq.
We
don't even have a war on Al-Qaeda. You've got Al-Qaeda criminals out there who need to be...
I agree.
So the way, in my mind, the way to bust up that frame is to say the so-called war on terror.
Exactly. But you see liberals using their frame. It just feeds right into their...
I agree with you, Tom.
And then another one. We should say 20,000 casualties, of which 2,500 are dead and 17,000 are maimed for life.
Yeah,
but use the word 20, or the number 20,000.
Yeah. Yes. Yesterday, by the way, somebody sent me a link to a website that counts how many contractors have died. It looks like it's over 300.
Okay.
And so it's 300 contractors plus we're pushing 2,400 troops. Pretty soon, the total number, and not to mention, 400 in Afghanistan. I have a feeling you add all those numbers up, and we're probably over the number of people who died in 9/11. And
I
hope somebody does the math on that. And when that magic number is reached, that's something that needs to be trumpeted in the media.
Well, why not 20,000 casualties, which includes the people that are blinded?
That needs to be mentioned constantly. I agree with you, Tom, but I'm looking for a news hook here, something that CNN will pick up. And I think, you know, the number of people who've died as a result of Bush's reactive measures are identical to the number of people who have died in what he said he was reacting to. That's something that would make the news.
Right. And the reason I say Al-Qaeda, it'll expose these guys aren't fighting Al-Qaeda.
No, they're absolutely not. And Tom, well said. Vince in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Hey, Vince, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Yesterday I listened to the president, and it seemed to me that he was blaming the news media for all of his bad, negative images.
Sure.
And I just wondered, it took 3 years for him to call on Helen Thomas, and she asked him a question that should have been asked every day by everyone there, and he started giving her all types of gobbledygook, and when she tried to interrupt him to say that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, he got mad. And he went into a long explanation explaining that Al-Qaeda was trained in Iraq, and Iraq this and Iraq that, and Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Right.
And it seems to me that the Democrats are running scared. So all you have to do is say that they're unpatriotic, they're not supporting the troops, you know, and the troops are in harm's way fighting for these people. He did it to John Kerry. And I really think that this man has lied enough now that he should be impeached. I'm not interested in... a censor. I'm interested in an impeachment. He's lied about...
Vince, if you want George W. Bush to be impeached, you need to show up at your local county Democratic office and say, what can I do right now to help the strongest candidate get out there and win the primary and then win in the general election?
I've gone through that already.
Yeah, because that's the bottom line. It's all going to be about what happens at the grassroots level. It's all going to be about what happens, you know, how many of us actually get out there and get active. And, Vince, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. This is the absolute bottom line, is grassroots activism in the United States. It's the only way to take back the Democratic Party. It's the only way to take back this country. And frankly, it's the way the Republicans did it over a 30-year period, starting with the churches and big business, you know, this unholy alliance. They did it. We can do it, too. Time to take back America. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. In the Darwinian world of ideas, we're at the top of the food chain here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Thank you for joining us. Amazing things happening over in Asia. Our Asia alert. North Korea has words for America today. Of course, the song is in Chinese, but, you know, same region, I suppose. North Korea suggested Tuesday it had the ability to launch a preemptive attack on the United States. According to the North's official news agency, foreign ministry spokesman said the North has built atomic weapons specifically to counter the U.S. nuclear threat. As we declared, the spokesman said, according to the Korean Central News Agency, as we declared our strong revolutionary might, put in place all measures to counter possible U.S. preemptive strikes. Preemptive strike is not the monopoly of the United States anymore. In fact, the foreign ministry spokesman said, we have built nuclear weapons for no other purpose than to counter U.S. nuclear threats. The North spokesman said it would be a wise step for the United States to cooperate on nuclear issues with North Korea in the same way it does with India. India, you will recall, refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, developed a nuclear weapon in secret, and what did we do in response to that? Well, a week or so, George W. went over to India and said, General Electric and Bechtel would like to sell you some more nuclear reactors. And Kim Jong-il thinks he can essentially say the same. This is mind-boggling. North Korea has threatened us with a preemptive nuclear strike. This is the logical consequence of Bush, of the Bush administration, of the Republicans, not just the Bush administration, and the Republicans in the House of Representatives, and the Republicans in the United States Senate, and the Republicans in the media, and a few Democratic conservatives, of all these cons out there beating the drum for the idea that preemptive strikes, that we can prevent war by striking first. Yes, of course, if there is a true threat to this country, you stop it. And that is consistent with international law, but it was never established that Iraq represented a true threat to the United States. Never established. In fact, when George Bush talks about it, he has to resort to lies, saying that, they wouldn't let our inspectors in. You know, I'm serious. No, I'm
not making this up.
No, I'm not. I'm telling you. He actually says this.
The larger point is,
stuff.
And the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Because he wouldn't let the inspectors in. Those inspectors like Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei. You'll recall Hans Blix, the inspector who was let in, who was traveling all over Iraq, who was issuing reports, who, according to Resolution 1441, was the only guy, well, him and Mohammed al-Baradei, the only one of only two people who could actually authorize strike. Well, actually, the Security Council had to authorize it. The way 1441 was written, the inspectors go in. If the inspectors certify to the Security Council that Saddam Hussein was in significant noncompliance with Resolution 1441, that he was either preventing the inspectors from doing their work or they found evidence that he had weapons of mass destruction, then the Security Council could call a second vote and call for military action. Bush short-circuited that and said, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to violate a UN resolution. We're going to attack a country that represents no threat to us. And Hans Blix said, you know, we've heard of this before. This was, you know, this kind of behavior. We've seen this before in Europe. We know about this. We remember the Inquisition.
You know, in the Middle Ages when people were convinced there were witches and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
Yeah, but Bush, no. In Bush's world, it's him against the world. I mean, right down to inside his own cabinet.
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
And now it turns out that a lot of the lawyers who were... Well, wait a minute. Hang on just a second here. You're either with us, A, or against us, B. You're either evil, A, or you're good, B. So if you're with us, you're evil. Did I hear that right? Is that... Got to hear that again.
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Well, in any case, it turns out that I guess the evil top lawyers at the White House warned this Newsweek, Michael Isikoff, writing in Newsweek. The White House's top lawyer warned more than 2 years ago that U.S. officials could be prosecuted for war crimes. Here's Bush's lawyers telling him that he could be prosecuted for war crimes as a result of new and unorthodox measures used by the Bush administration in the war on terrorism, according to an internal White House memo and interviews with participants in the debate over the issue. This is a January 25, 2002 memo by Alberto Gonzalez. The concern about possible future prosecution for war crimes and that it might even apply to Bush administration officials themselves is contained in a crucial portion of an internal January 25, 2002 memo by White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez obtained by Newsweek. It urges President George Bush to declare the war in Afghanistan, including the detention of Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters, exempt from the provisions of the Geneva Convention, which, to the best of my knowledge, he has never done. In the memo, Gonzalez, the White House lawyer, focused on a little-known 1996 law passed by Congress known as the War Crimes Act. Oh, the War Crimes Act, that's a little-known law. Yeah. That banned any Americans from committing war crimes. Defined in part as grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. By the way, we can't commit war crimes because we're a signatory to the Geneva Conventions and to the United Nations, the treaties that brought the United Nations into being. Back to Newsweek, noting that the law applied to U.S. officials and that punishments for violators, quote, include the death penalty, end quote. Yes, Gonzalez actually wrote this in a memo to Bush saying, we might be prosecuted for war crimes. We could face penalties that, quote, quoting Alberto Gonzalez, quote, include the death penalty, end quote. Gonzalez told Bush, quote, it was difficult to predict with confidence, end quote, how Justice Department prosecutors might apply the law in the future. In other words, if the administration is no longer run by George W. Bush, might the actual Justice Department itself, might the Attorney General of the United States prosecute a former president, a former president's lawyer, Alberto Gonzalez, and former members of the administration with war crimes under this 1996 law, the War Crimes Act, and they could face the death penalty. Gonzalez, quoting Alberto Gonzalez, writing to George W. Bush personally, it is difficult to predict the motives of prosecutors and independent counsels who may, in the future, decide to pursue unwarranted charges based on Section 2441 of the War Crimes Act. Yeah, they may pursue unwarranted charges. Oh, of course, we're innocent. We know we're innocent. By the way, George, you better do something quick because we could be facing the death penalty. If this is not mind-boggling, tell me what is. At the same time, Jess Braven, writing in today's Wall Street Journal, the White House will reverse policy, ban evidence elicited by torture. The Bush administration will bar statements made under torture from its Guantanamo Bay military courts, reversing a White House decision in July that could have allowed such evidence to convict suspected terrorists held at the U.S. Naval base in Cuba. Hey, wait a minute. I thought we didn't use torture. I thought that was the official line. Now they're saying, oh, yeah, well, we torture people. And by the way, we won't use those statements in court. Why not? Well, because it's been illegal forever. The new rule expected to be issued this week comes before Supreme Court arguments next Tuesday over the legality of the special court. This is where you get to it. So the Supreme Court can't rule on something that's no longer at law. So if the White House changes the rules right now, then this case that's coming before the Supreme Court about whether these special courts comply with the UN Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment will be thrown out. The Bush administration once more leaping ahead of the guillotine. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them. You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them the old hocus-pocus. You misdirected them. With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, you played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott's with us. He's the chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
Great to have you. I noticed at the top of VAWatchdog.org you have the photos of Jim Nicholson, the VA secretary, Republican, Steve Beyer, the chairman of the House VA Committee, Republican from Indiana, and Larry Craig, the Republican from Idaho, the chairman of the Senate VA Committee. Mm-hmm. How come three Republicans up at the top of your website?
Well, that's what we call a stacked deck.
I see.
First of all, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs is a political appointee position that is named by the president, so obviously we're going to have a Republican there. And because we have Republican majorities in the House and Senate, we have those power people boosted into the chairmanship of the committee. Steve Beyer from Indiana, chairman of the House Committee, and Larry Craig from Idaho, chairman of the Senate Committee. And also you have Republican majorities on all of those committees. It tends to put an end to the term bipartisan.
Yeah, so these are the guys you're keeping an eye on.
Yeah, yeah, guys, you're a very close eye on what they're doing.
Your subtitle says keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. And obviously these guys are not. What's the biggest issue that the VA is facing right now? Veterans are facing right now.
Well, right now it's underfunding is what the VA is facing. And last week on the Senate floor we had a roll call vote. An amendment was voted down 54-46 along party lines that would have made VA health care funding mandatory. Right now, the VA health care budget is discretionary. It has to be argued over and fought over every year. And we've been trying for years to make this part of the mandatory budget, where we have calculations of how many veterans need health care. They take into account annual changes. There is an assured stream of funding. And this comes up over and over and over. Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan offered the amendment. And last week it was Senate Amendment 3141, and boom, it was voted down right along party lines. Plain and simple.
Let me just get this clear. The Republicans who claim to be gung-ho support the troops. You know, 9 times out of 10, you see somebody with a support the troops bumper sticker and you ask them their political affiliation, they'd say they're a Republican. Mm-hmm. The Republicans voted down a piece of legislation that would have required appropriate funding of health care for veterans.
Yes.
And the Democrats voted for it, but because they're in the minority, this piece of legislation died.
That's right. It's just that simple.
There's no little subtext to this. No gotcha. There wasn't something in there that said, oh, and by the way, impeach the president.
No, it wasn't impeach the president. How they were going to fund it. Remember, nobody's going to raise taxes at this point in time. The Republicans won't allow that. So what you have to look for is a budget offset. The budget offset here that would have fully funded VA health care would have been handled by restoring the pre-2001 top rate for income tax for people who make over $1 million.
It's tax time here, Larry
right.
Scott, with VAWatchdog.org. And if you earned more than $1 million last year, on average, you got a $100,000 tax rebate or tax cut. How'd you do?
I didn't get anything. What this basically would have done, this would have meant for the very, very wealthiest people in the country, they would have lost about 1% of their tax refund over a period of the next few years when you extrapolate out all the figures. So that was the only place they could find in the budget where they could get any funding for this, and it was voted down. The Republicans said, nope, our tax cuts for the wealthy are more important than health care for veterans. And the veterans are having a very difficult time right now. The Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA again, has done some very unusual things with their numbers. We're finding veterans waiting longer and longer for health care. And just a set of numbers that just came out, Tom, is very interesting. The VA had estimated the troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan that need VA health care would be about 110,000 of them this year in fiscal year 2006.
Mm-hmm.
We have the figures in for the first quarter for October, November, and December, more than 144,000 returning troops have sought health care at the VA.
More than 20% more than they were expecting.
Well, yes, and if you extrapolate it on an annual basis, you will find that the error factor is 5-1. They missed it by a factor of 5-1. Because they missed that, I think we're going to find ourselves again in a budget shortfall once again this year, with the troops not being able to be taken care of when they come home.
That's a disaster. You can learn more about it over at VAWatchdog.org. Larry Scott, thanks for being with us today, Larry.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I always appreciate your insights.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll talk to you later. It's absolutely incredible what this administration is doing, and they still go around beating the drum like they're all about the military. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hart.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Traffic jam, staring at the faces in a rearview mirror, looking at the promise of the promised land.
And welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The more you dig into this thing, the more obvious it becomes that the Bush administration is either running scared or attempting to manipulate a Supreme Court process. This whole thing about the White House reversing their policy on banning evidence elicited by torture. This is in today's Wall Street Journal. Jess Braven wrote the article. And as you dig into it, here in summary is what's been going on. First of all, the White House says, we don't torture people. The Supreme Court says, you've got to have some trials for some of these guys down at Guantanamo. They're entitled to due process. And so then there's this debate within the White House about whether or not evidence obtained under torture can be used in the trials. Now, the history of civilization, or at least the history of the last few hundred years of civilization, is the consensus, the knowledge that information obtained under torture is pretty useless information. I mean, look at the people. One of the reasons why Ben Franklin left Boston and moved to Philadelphia, left Massachusetts, moved to where he was born and moved to Philadelphia, when he was 17 years old, as I recall, was because they were still prosecuting witches. I mean, they were hanging witches in the 1600s in Massachusetts. Well, you torture somebody long enough, they'll confess to anything. And they were confessing to witchcraft, certain, as Hans Blix pointed out. And he's referring to middle-aged Europe, but in any case, so there's this debate in the Bush administration. Do we use evidence against people where they've incriminated themselves under torture or not? And then the thing gets moved to the Supreme Court. On behalf of some of these detainees, there's this lawsuit that goes to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is going to begin hearing this thing fairly soon. And whether or not the U.S. has the authority to hold these guys, this whole issue, well, not the whole issue, actually, a very small slice of the issue is going to end up before the Supreme Court. And Haynes, William J. Haynes II, this is where it gets really kind of complex and interesting. William J. Haynes II is the guy who had been opposing a rule that would prevent the use of torture-obtained evidence. In other words, he had been saying, if you've got evidence obtained under torture, it's okay to use it. William J. Haynes II. He's the general counsel to the Pentagon. So George W. Bush rewards him and nominates him for a lifetime seat on a federal appeals court, one step short of the Supreme Court. The Democrats step in and say, wait a minute, this guy is arguing that evidence obtained under torture should be able to be used in the trials of people at Guantanamo. We're not going to put this guy on a federal court. And so now Haynes is changing his tune. As Jesse Braven in the Wall Street Journal writes, but in recent weeks, Mr. Haynes, whose nomination to a federal appeals court has been stalled by Senate Democrats critical of prisoner treatment policies, reconsidered the matter, the Defense Department spokeswoman said. So, to eliminate any doubt that the torture convention applies to the commissions, Mr. Haynes has issued a formal instruction that bars prosecutors from offering as evidence any statement obtained as a result of torture and bars commissions from admitting such evidence against an accused. Now, is Haynes doing this because he wants to be nominated to a federal appeals court seat? I don't think so. I don't think it's about, kowtowing to the Democrats. No, instead what it is this a piece of this case is going to end up before the Supreme Court. And the way the Supreme Court works is if the Supreme Court is ruling on something, it has to be an existing law. The Supreme Court does not have the ability, they do not have the power to rule on something which is no longer a law, because what they're ruling on essentially is whether a law is lawful, and if it's not a law, or whether it's constitutional, and if it's not a law, it can't be deemed constitutional or unconstitutional. It's not relevant anymore. A law or a policy or whatever it may be. And so here what we have, in my opinion, is the Bush administration trying to avoid losing before the Supreme Court, which could then flip them back to that situation that I was telling you about before the break, where Alberto Gonzalez is writing to George W. Bush a private memo that just came out in, Michael Isikoff just released this in Newsweek, a private memo to George W. Bush saying that he and Bush could be facing serious consequences if a future Justice Department looks back on their actions today. That they could face sanctions which, quoting Gonzalez's letter to Bush, which, quote, include the death penalty, end quote. In other words, Gonzalez telling Bush that the both of them could face the death penalty for what they're doing in violation of the War Crimes Act of 1996. Well, they can't have that coming up. So what they've got to do is stop the Supreme Court from ruling on this. Well, if the Supreme Court is going to be ruling on some dimension of the torture, then they can short-circuit that by simply saying, well, we're not going to allow torture or evidence obtained under torture, even if it means blowing up the cases that they, you know, these prosecutions that they were going to follow, which, in, you know, only makes sense. I mean, you've in modern America, in the civilized world, we don't use evidence obtained from people under torture against them. It's not reliable. So you getting this? I mean, this is really a big story. It's a little tiny article in the Wall Street Journal, but it's really a big story. This is a big deal. The Bush, Jess Braven's piece, the Bush administration will bar statements made under torture from its Guantanamo Bay military courts, reversing a White House decision in July that could have allowed such evidence to convict suspected terrorists held at the U.S. Naval Base in Cuba. The new rule, expected to be issued this week, comes before Supreme Court arguments next Tuesday over the legality of the special courts, known as military commissions, which President Bush authorized after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks to prosecute non-U.S. citizens for war crimes. This, you get it? You getting with it? The dance is here? There's like layers of subtlety to this thing. The move could help the commission survive Supreme Court review, writes Jess Braven in today's Wall Street Journal, because government lawyers can argue that the special courts comply, I would say now comply, with the United Nations Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. See, if we sign a treaty, which the UN Convention is, if we sign a treaty, that becomes the law of the land. And that, by the way, is a constitutional law, and so the Supreme Court would, they're just looking into the future, and they're saying, you know, if the Supreme Court rules on this thing, if the Supreme Court, and the arguments begin on Tuesday, and if one of the arguments put before the Supreme Court is that these courts, these kangaroo courts that they've got down there at Guantanamo are not legal because they are sentencing people to death based on confessions that were obtained under torture, then the courts will get thrown out. Then the whole Guantanamo concentration camp thing collapses legally, and George Bush is left being, you know, the first guy since Franklin Roosevelt, tragically, to have concentration camps, although at least Roosevelt wasn't running kangaroo courts and sentencing people to death. I mean, they're actually building a death chamber down there at Camp 6 in Guantanamo Bay to handle executions. And maybe, I don't know, maybe they're putting in a crematorium as well to dispose of the bodies. Or maybe I'm take them out to sea, or what are they going to ship them back to Afghanistan or Iraq? Who knows? But so, anyhow, the treaty, which the U.S. ratified in 1994, thus becoming part of the law of the land, requires member countries to exclude statements taken under torture from, quote, any proceeding, end quote. Lawyers for Salem Hamdan, the Guantanamo defendant challenging the commissions before the high court, argue that the commissions are illegal in part because they could consider statements taken under torture. And in an affidavit, a sworn affidavit, he said he was confronted with American interrogators in Afghanistan and threatened him with death, torture, or prison when I did not know the answers to their questions. They also, here's another piece of the article, U.S. officials have long insisted that they neither torture nor send prisoners nor send them to third countries to do so, but many current and former prisoners maintain they were tortured, and some have described beatings, psychological abuse, and sensory deprivation. One Guantanamo defendant maintains he confessed after U.S. authorities sent him to Morocco, where an interrogator cut his chest and genitals with a scalpel. So now we've got Mr. Haynes, who Bush wants to put on the appeals courts, saying, okay, we're going to change our minds here because we've got to keep our kangaroo courts. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So to kind of summarize it, 9 minutes before the hour, by the way, welcome back. We're coming up on that. It's about 10 minutes to right now. Tom Hartman here with you. To summarize this, the Bush administration has these kangaroo courts going on down at Guantanamo that they're using, that they plan on using to actually convict prisoners in ways that could cause them to be sentenced to death. They are building a death chamber down there so they can hold the trial, judge people guilty, and put them to death all right on the spot, right there in Guantanamo. And one of the guys who has been, is a prisoner down there and is facing trial, says that he confessed to what he confessed to because he was tortured. And this is going before the Supreme Court. They're going to start hearing arguments on it next Tuesday. And if the Bush administration continues to argue that they can use information obtained through torture, in this guy's case, not in this guy's case, but in another case here, this guy, is the interrogators used a scalpel to cut open his genitals. And he said, I'll tell you, yes, I did it. Okay, we'll stop now. If the Bush administration continues to assert that they can use torture-derived evidence to convict these guys down in Guantanamo and put them to death out of sight of the rest of the world, they're going to lose before the Supreme Court. And in the future, according to a memo that Alberto Gonzalez wrote to George W. Bush 2 years ago that just came out today in Newsweek, and in the future, if a Democrat is elected president and the Justice Department is no longer marching to the Bush tune, in the future, George W. Bush and Alberto Gonzalez could face the death penalty under U.S. law for propagating, for putting forward this kind of a war crime. So anyhow, that's the bottom line. And in the middle of all this thing, you got this, you know, Haynes guy who is trying to get on the district court or on the Superior Court. Somebody earlier had asked, you know, why is it that Bush doesn't pay any attention to anything anybody says? Why does he not listen to his own, the people around him? Why doesn't he listen to we the people? This is an interesting, this is from Duke University, dukemednews.com or .org. When high-ranking monkeys are shown images of other monkeys glancing one way or the other, they more readily follow the gaze of other high-ranking monkeys, Duke University Medical Center neurobiologists have discovered. By contrast, they tend to ignore glance cues from low-status monkeys. So high-status monkeys only pay attention to other high-status monkeys. They don't pay attention to low-status monkeys. Low-status monkeys, however, assiduously follow the gaze of all other monkeys. So here we are, we the people, we're all paying attention to everything that's going on, what we say, what Bush says, what everybody says. Bush, however, considers himself high status. He's not paying attention to, and this apparently is hardwired. They're going to go on, they say, they're going to try and find out what hormonal and or genetic influences determine who becomes the monkey or human equivalent of Donald Trump and who becomes a Woody Allen. Well, I would say it's really simple. Donald Trump was born a millionaire. His daddy gave him millions of dollars and, you know, he turned it into hundreds of millions. George W. Bush, born a millionaire. I suspect there's more nurture than nature in this, although you never know. It's probably a little bit of both. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Charles in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Oh, am I on?
You are.
Okay, I wanted to pose a hypothetical question. What would happen if the Republicans tried to get out ahead of the curve and impeach Bush on their own?
He would probably get impeached. I mean, it depends on what you mean by the Republicans. The fact of the matter is that Bush and Rove control the Republican Party right now, and they control it with you know, threats of, you know, fear. I mean, they're basically using fear. They, for example, you had Pat Roberts out there, 3 months ago, saying we're going to have investigations, and Arlen Specter saying we're going to have investigations into this NSA wiretap thing. Now there's no investigations. What happened? These guys, you know, they got a phone call from Karl Rove. It's like they're dealing with the mafia.
Yeah. So I think that they're going to suffer in the polls in the fall.
They're suffering in the polls already. In the elections. Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. You know, from your lips to God's ears, Charles, as they say. I really hope that's what happens. And it's going to be what happens if enough of us get out there and get involved. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. But you know, in a way, you're asking, like, you know, what would happen if men from Mars took over the moon or something. It's just, you know, it ain't going to happen. Bonnie in Burkittstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. I'm calling about framing the issues and anticipating the neocon frame as from the last hour. But I wanted to say about what you were just recently talking about. It just seems that every law, rule, policy that makes our nation look good in the eyes of the world, for instance, not using torture-derived evidence, it this administration sees them as an obstacle to their personal agenda.
Yeah. I frankly don't care what the rest of the world thinks. I don't think that Bush cares what we think. I don't think he cares what the rest of the world thinks. He doesn't care what his own father thinks.
Who
is a former president, and you would think, you know, and basically ran this country for, you know, what, 4, 8, 12 years, you know, most of the Reagan presidency and all of the Bush presidency.
Well, anticipating the neocon frame, I don't think you can ever be too cynical. Did you see Alan Simpson with Barbara Boxer and Larry King, I think it was Monday night earlier this week?
I caught a piece of it.
Well, they were talking about the third anniversary of the war, and Boxer mm-hmm. started talking about the loss of life. So Simpson interjected with a comment similar to, well, we don't need to get all emotional.
That's right, yeah. And every time she tried to bring it up, he was like, that's not fair, Barbara.
I know. And she tried to defend her position by talking about how she feels when so many Californians who needlessly lost their lives because so many troops are either from California or based there. Then he came back with, well, are you saying the California lives are more important than Wyoming lives? Something like that. Well, then they went to a break, and I turned off the TV, but I was screaming at him. You know, he really pushed my button, and because he's dismissing the discussion of any soldier's death as merely emotional. And it was a cheap shot, because when you accuse a woman of being emotional, you get, you know, you want to look logical.
Yeah.
So I hope, you know, did you watch the end of it? Because I hope
I
he had an opportunity to deconstruct him. And but like I said, I don't think you can ever be too cynical in anticipating what the neocon frame is going to be.
No, and he was playing right into the frame of basically cutting her down and dismissing her, A, because she was female, and B, because he said that she was trying to politicize death, and, you know, how dare you do that. And but wait a minute, these are deaths that are the consequence of a political process.
Exactly.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, thank you, Bonnie, for pointing that out. It's good to be reminded of these things. Larry in Seattle. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom. Afghanistan has got a Christian man that converted from Islam to Christianity on trial. Ultimate penalty is a death penalty. This was written into the Afghan Constitution.
Yeah.